Okay, so what I want to do is just give a brief overview of the yogic tradition. And I'd like to dedicate this to a particular person, specifically George Feuerstein, who is the author of many, many texts on yoga. He's probably the greatest Western scholar practitioner of yoga in the world at this time. And at this very moment, he's dying. And I just got an email, a beautiful email from his wife saying that he was dying, and she was doing something very beautiful. She was holding him and had sent out an email to people who knew his work, inviting them to send a message to him. And so as he's dying, she is reading these messages from people around the world to him, which is just very, very beautiful. So this is a man who has contributed enormously to our understanding of yoga, probably more than anyone in the West in our time. And so most of this talk is derived from his books, particularly this beautiful little summary text, the Shambhala Guide to Yoga, which is really the nicest summary of yoga I know. And I'd like to dedicate this to George, and I think that tomorrow I will, if he's still alive, I'll send an email to him just telling him that we spent the evening drawing on his wisdom. So the term yoga has two different meanings. One is discipline and one is union, and both of these are central to this tradition. It's part of a 5,000-year-old tradition dating back to the civilization that grew up around the Indus and Saraswati rivers, river basins in India. And elements of it are evident in the Rig Veda. The Vedas are the oldest of the Hindu texts, dating back some 5,000 years in the case of the Rig Veda, making it the oldest known text in the Indo-European language. But yoga appears as a formal discipline some 2,500 years ago, first in the Upanishads, which we read, and the Bhagavad Gita, which we also read, the most beloved spiritual text of India. And it crystallized into its so-called classic yoga formulation around the second century of the Common Era with Patanjali Sutras, which we've been reading, which consists of these 195 aphoristic little verses. Yoga is like psychotherapy in several ways, in that there are several schools of yoga, each of them focusing on a particular aspect of mind. So just as in psychotherapy, we have, for example, cognitive therapy, which focuses on thoughts and beliefs, and we have, for example, behavior therapy, which focuses on overt behavior and modifying that, and so forth. So, too, yoga has its divisions according to what aspect of mind or behavior it focuses on. There are four main divisions of yoga: Jnana Yoga, which is the yoga of the intellect; Karma Yoga, which is the yoga of action or behavior; Bhakti, which is the yoga of the heart; and Raja, which is the classical yoga, the yoga of meditation. So Jnana Yoga is the yoga which focuses on using the intellect, but it uses it in a very specific way, not so much as cognitive therapy does to work with individual thoughts, but rather through the practice of discernment, constantly looking at what is real and what is fantasy, what is relative, what is absolute, looking to see and doing the practice, looking to see that it reaches the ultimate realization that all experiences and phenomena are not absolute reality. That absolute reality is only that which is the witness of all these things, the self with a capital S, or Atman. Karma Yoga is the yoga of work and action in the world. It's the yoga which all of us are practitioners of. Because unless you're in a monastery, if you're a serious spiritual practitioner, you really want to be a Karma Yogi. Because Karma Yoga is the yoga of taking our everyday actions, in fact, every action, and transforming it into a spiritual practice by three things in particular. One, dedicating all actions to a higher good. traditionally Brahman or God. Can be the service of all beings, for example, or the service of others. Secondly, doing it as impeccably as possible. And third, and here's the kicker, which makes it into such a knife-edge practice, doing it as impeccably and wholeheartedly as possible, but relinquishing attachment to the outcome. It's that which pairs away attachment aversion, rips away the egocentric ideas of having it turn out the way I think it should. Bhakti yoga is the yoga of the heart, the cultivation of the higher emotions, particularly, most of all, love. Love to a spiritual level, love which is trans-egoic, which encompasses all beings, which embraces all life. And finally, Raja Yoga, so-called eight-limbed or classic yoga. And Raja Yoga is the yoga which has, which most of us think of as yoga. It's the yoga which has the the eight limbs, and we'll go through these in a little more detail in a moment. But starting with morality or ethics, moving into discipline, then into postures, the asana, which is what we usually associate with yoga in the West, then breath control, which Priyal was giving us a little taste of before, then the so-called inner limbs, four inner limbs, sense withdrawal, concentration practice, meditation, and samadhi. And so those are the four main yogas, the jnana yoga, the yoga of the intellect, karma, the yoga of work and action in the world, bhakti, the yoga of love and devotion, and raja yoga, the classical or eight-limbed yoga. And there are others, mantra yoga, hatha yoga. In the yogic tradition, there's an emphasis on the necessity of having a teacher of some kind. And this is common throughout spiritual traditions, but greatly emphasized in yoga, where the term that's most often used is guru, which means heavy or weighty. And an esoteric translation means dispeller of darkness. Ideally, this person needs to be someone who has realized themselves, who's awake themselves, because just as there's a saying in psychotherapy, it's hard to help someone mature beyond your own level. Also in yoga, it's said, you know, it's hard to help someone realize beyond your own level. Then on the student side, it's important to realize that in yoga, as in spiritual traditions in general, that the teacher-student relationship is seen as a major commitment by both people. And it's not something to be taken on lightly. We in the West, having seen the results of immature student-teacher relationships, unripe teachers and unripe students, where both get into trouble, usually through the classic triad of money, sex, or power, it's important to realize that choosing a teacher is a major undertaking. The Dalai Lama recommends taking a decade to test a person out. But it's also a major undertaking for a teacher, because just as when we in our role as healers and psychotherapists and physicians, you know what it's like to take on a patient. I mean, if you end up feeling really committed to this person, well, even more so in the spiritual traditions, to take on a student for a guru is a big deal. And so they test them out too. And if you look in this tradition or other traditions like the Sufi traditions or Zen, I mean, man, what they put people through before they even let them in the door is amazing. You know, in Zen, they think nothing of having a person sit in the snow in meditation for a day and a night before they'll open the door for them. So there's the recognition that this is not a, you know, we tend to think, oh, yeah, we'll find a teacher, and, you know, they're dime a dozen, look one up on the web, etc. But traditionally, it's thought that becoming involved with a teacher is a really major commitment on both sides. And it requires a commitment in the student, in the yogic tradition, particularly to two things: discipline practice and dispassion, that is, the willingness to relinquish craving, attachment, and become reach a point of what's called vairagya, which probably is close to our sense of equanimity. Okay, so what are the practices at the core of yoga? Well, as with every tradition, every spiritual tradition, the foundation begins with ethics, the first of the eightfold limbs. But ethics, not as we in the conventional West think of ethics, as, you know, kind of trying to avoid harm or simply trying to avoid harm or do this or God will get you. That's a very conventional level understanding. The spiritual and yogic understanding is far more profound. It's the recognition that ethics is a very profound spiritual practice in and of itself, and that to be ethical, by which I mean I would define an intention as ethical to the extent that it intends to enhance the well-being of everyone, including oneself. If it doesn't include yourself, it's sacrifice. And sacrifice breeds resentment and problems. So ethics intends the well-being of everyone, including oneself. And what you recognize as you begin to work with ethics is that it's a wonderful form of mind training. If you look internally, any time you're tempted to be unethical, that is to harm someone, including yourself, what you'll notice is the mind is filled at that moment with painful, destructive motives and emotions like greed and fear and anger and jealousy and hatred. And if you act them out, you strengthen them. On the other hand, that's the bad news. The good news is that if we act ethically, at those moments, if you turn attention inward, you find that your mind is filled with motives and emotions, very healthy, very beneficial, very beautiful, like love and joy and compassion. And if you act those out, you strengthen them or condition them, or in yogic terms, increase their karmic impact. Okay? So this is a very deep understanding of ethics that yoga is based on. And it's based on this recognition and a still deeper recognition. Because fundamentally, everything in ethics starts to make complete sense once you realize that it's based on the recognition that the same transcendent self looks out through the eyes of every conscious creature. And that the words of Jesus, treat your brother as yourself with a capital S, can be seen as an expression of that. So once you get that there's only the one self looking out through each of us, then ethical action just becomes what you want to do. It ceases to be seen as a sacrifice in any way. It becomes a natural expression of a transcendent recognition. Okay. So yoga breaks ethics down into five precepts. It's called yama, or discipline. First is non-harming, ahimsa, which is sometimes described, for example, by Gandhi as the great ethical principle foundation of India. Non-harming. Second is truthfulness, truth-telling, which again is a practice unto itself, which maybe we can discuss at some time. And I have come to really appreciate the extraordinary profundity of the words of Jesus. Say only what the truth will set you free. It's an extraordinarily profound statement. And I found no better summary of the practice of truth-telling than the words of the Buddha, say only what is true and helpful. So, first of the five elements of ethics in yoga, non-harming. Second, truthfulness. Third, non-stealing. Fourth, brahmacharya, which is traditionally translated as celibacy, also more generally as sexual ethics. And this reflect and the emphasis on sexual ethics, or if you're in retreat or doing full-on practice celibacy, is based on several goals. First, on non-harming, sexual ethics. Second, on reducing attachments, celibacy being a way of just working with with sexual attachments and cravings. Third is an energetic working, and there are three main kinds of energetic work that working with sexual restraint does. First, it fosters a conservation of energy. If you're doing intense work, like in a retreat, spiritual work, like in a retreat, you deliberately try to conserve sexual energy, because you find, if you don't discharge it, that it's available as energy, pure energy, really energizes the whole system. So conservation of energy, transformation of energy. You find also that if you don't discharge the sexual energy, that there's the possibility of actually allowing it to transform, or as in Tantra, working with it energetically to transmute it into more refined forms of energy. And then there's the redirection of energy. Because what you find, if you observe the energetic currents, and it's interesting to pay really close attention to the energetic currents associated with sexuality, you find that sexuality is associated with a kind of downward movement of attention. It tends to pull attention down towards the genitals and also into the body. But it's possible, after you've worked with it for a while energetically, to actually redirect that energy so it moves, the experience is kind of moves up the spinal cord or up the chakras, and actually moves attention up into transpersonal, transcendental realms. So those three kind of energetic elements of working with sexuality: conservation of energy, transmutation into other kinds and more refined kinds of energy, and redirection. Okay, and that dovetails with the fifth element of ethics, which is non-greed. Okay, so if you look at these eight limbs, the first, the foundation of all spiritual work, is ethics. The second of the limbs is discipline, and the core practices here are purity, which is basically purifying or working with so as to cultivate only wholesome mind states, specifically ethical behavior, positive emotions, positive motives or ethical motives, a working with thought, and even working with attention, what the Buddhists would call wise attention. That is, out of the recognition that the mind takes on the characteristics of what you attend to. So yoga emphasizes purification, and with that attention, being careful what you pay attention to. And we all know that. Just spend 20 minutes watching TV and see what it does to your mind. It's like, you got to give Hollywood credit. I mean, I noticed in myself, most of those programs are designed to pull out greed and lust and anger and all these powerful emotions and just capture attention. Very good. I mean, they certainly work on me. But it's a good example of just how powerful what you pay attention to can be. So core disciplines of self-restraint, the second limb of yoga, then purification. Contentment is this. Contentment, just being content with what is. A very powerful practice. Then there's austerity, the willingness to put oneself through whatever is required for spiritual awakening. Not saying suffering is good, but being willing to open to suffering that arises as part of one's practice. Not giving up the practice or closing down mentally, but rather being open to it and willing to work with it. study. Intellectual study has a role. We need a frame. We need an intellectual framework. There are good. It's good to study spiritual texts, have those thoughts running around our head. And then finally, the final element of the second limb, devotion. Okay. Some body practices. In yoga, the body is seen as the so-called cosmic or Brahmic egg from which all pleasurable and painful stimuli arise. And yoga is sometimes described as the cracking of the egg, that is, the escaping the karmic inevitabilities that for most people come with physical sensations and experience. Until we begin a practice, we are so compelled by pleasurable and painful experiences, we're basically slaves to our bodies. And yoga aims to, through all its practices, to free us from that inevitable enslavement to seeking the pleasurable or craving the pleasurable stimuli and avoiding the painful ones of the body, so we can come to peace and equanimity. And the practices include body cleansing, relaxation, which is said to be the alpha and omega of yoga, postures, the asanas, and diet. In India, there's an Indian maxim which is beautiful: as one's food, so is one's mind. And it's basically a lacto-vegetarian diet for both health and yogic and ethical reasons. Next element of yoga is breath control, or working with breath. Priyal gave us a taste of that. It said that breath control is the doorway to mental control. And breath is said to be the expression and source or channeler of energy, of prana. And as we work with breath, we modify our energy and through that the mind. And yoga actually is based on a view of human nature which gives a very central role to energy, and said that our true nature, our Atman, is encased in five sheaths, or five koshas, or sheaths, or bodies. There's the anamaya kosha, which is the physical body. We all have an experience of that, of being kind of embodied, like there's a, we have this intuitive sense of there's a me here, and you know I'm in this body. But then yoga points out that when we become really sensitive to our experience, do some of the meditations such as we just did, that sense of the body breaks down into a sense of energy, of raw energetic experience. And then we experience being embodied in an energetic body. And then at a still more subtle level, there's the experience of just being having the mental sheath, the manomaya kosha, the sheath of the mind. And then there's, beyond that, at a very refined level, there's the sense of the higher mind or buddhi or wisdom mind, that a very refined sense of very subtle mental awareness and discernment. So at this level, we really get into very sensitive discernment. And then finally is Anandamaya Kosha, the sheath of bliss. Very interesting that we think of bliss as often as kind of the goal, and in one sense it is, but it's also a final barrier. And it's very easy to get seduced at that level when those moments of bliss arise, the mind to grasp onto that. And what yoga points us to is that that is a beautiful, deep yogic experience. And we have to be willing to let go of the bliss in order to recognize and identify and know and become ourselves as pure transcendental awareness, or the Atman. And we do that through the inner limbs of yoga, which go through first pratyahara, which is sense withdrawal. The traditional metaphor is the tortoise withdrawing limbs into the shell. So withdrawing, and these, as you can imagine, we're starting to get into advanced practices now, are withdrawing attention from the senses, turning them inward, and so we're not distracted by the bombardment of sensory experiences and can rest in internal awareness. And we've all had tastes of this, tastes where we're just the sensation, the body, the environment fade away, and we're left able to focus awareness internally. And then there's much more power for being able to work with the mind, to being able to rest in, for example, particular beneficent emotions like love and compassion, very focused attention, or in the bliss body. And so pratyahara, sense withdrawal, then that facilitates the next stage, dharana, which is concentration, the ability to hold attention on a particular object. And when that becomes more or less continuous, there's the possibility of moving into the stage of dhyana, or meditation, where there's sustained, clear awareness and attention, the ability to sustain attention on anything we want to hold attention on. For example, we want to cultivate love, to sustain attention on a loved one, and a fully attentive mind has extraordinary power to develop qualities. So by just being able to focus unwaveringly, for example, on a loved one or on divine love, then that emotion is strengthened and intensified dramatically. And then finally, samadhi, the stage in which there is unbroken, not just attention on object, but so sustained and refined an attention that the sense of a separate self sense breaks down. You may have had a taste of that in the meditation we did before. The separate self sense breaks down, and there's no sense of separation from experience. So the first level of samadhi is there's still mental phenomena arising. It may be love, it may be a vision of the cosmos, it may be a vision of a divinity, but it may be a division of one's inner guru or archetypal figure that you practice with, a figure embodying, say, love or compassion or wisdom. But now there's no separation from that. If one yogi meditates on Shiva, the divine figure, the wisdom, the great wisdom archetype, then there's no sense of separation. Soham Shiva, I am Shiva, is the mantra that goes with that. And that samadhi, there's no sense of separation. One is that, and those qualities or experiences, those are one's own. This is Savikalpa Samadhi, in our contemporary language of integral studies. This is a very refined, stable, subtle level realization. The mind is still there, but it's extremely subtle, extremely refined, extremely stable, and extremely spiritual. And one has any sense of separation from that. And then beyond that is Nirvikalpa Samadhi, where all objects disappear. One dissolves into pure awareness void, and this is samadhi without an object. This is the same void which can be experienced as quite terrifying to people who suddenly are catapulted into it without preparation or any preliminary understanding of what they're getting into. But when when an experienced practitioner merges into, dissolves into this pure awareness, void, plenum, this is what's liberating. But even this isn't the final possibility, because beyond this is Sahaj Samadhi, non-dual Samadhi, the possibility of retaining a continuous awareness of that transcendental self, that pure awareness, spirit, bliss, void, and of being aware of the body and the world at the same time. This is the Jivan Mukti, the liberated one while still alive, as the person who is able, who retains this awareness of Atman, of pure being, of Satchitananda, of awareness being bliss, rests in, abides in that, but simultaneously is aware of the body, the world, all phenomena, and even may recognize those as a spontaneous expression of that one mind at the same time. So all that's seen now is an expression, a manifestation, a projection of the divine. There is only the divine doing the divine play, or what's called lila, manifesting as each of us looking out through each of our eyes. And with at this final stage of Sahaj Samadhi, this is a continuous, spontaneous recognition. As you can see, the yoga offers this extraordinary path and exquisite vision of our possibilities. So this is a brief summary of this extraordinary tradition.